Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a weekly program of conversations with North State and national writers from North State Public Radio. Now here's your host, Nancy Wickman.
You might not recognize his name, but billions of people have seen his work. My guest today is the greatest dancer you've never heard of. Vincent Patterson is a director and choreographer in film, theater, Broadway, concert tours, opera, television, music videos, and commercials. He was one of the lead dancers in Michael Jackson's Beat It music video. Vincent Patterson's work includes Michael Jackson's Smooth Criminal and the famous Lean, and Madonna's Blonde Ambition tour. He directed Berlin's first original production of Cabaret, the longest running play in Berlin's history. Now, along with award-winning writer and storyteller Amy Tofty, Vincent Patterson has written a behind-the-scenes story of working with some of the world's greatest stars. The title of their book is Icons and Instincts, Choreographing and Directing Entertainment's Biggest Stars. Vincent Patterson, welcome.
Thank you, Nancy. I'm happy to be here.
Now, the name Patterson, and there's a famous writer Patterson, but he spells his name with two T's. How come your name, Patterson, only has one T?
Okay, I'll tell you a funny story about that. My grandfather was born in Northern England, and his relatives were from Scotland, actually. And he told us that his great-grandfather had told him, the Scottish great-grandfather, that they changed the name from two T's to one T because if they kept on writing, they would save so much money on lead that they would become rich one day. Now, of course, you know, that never happened to any of us, but that was the story that I got. So that's why we have one T in our name rather than two.
Well, when I was reading the story of your growing up, it was so familiar because a friend of mine, same age as you, I had to stop and think, now, whose story am I reading here? They sound so similar.
Wow.
Your dad, it seems like he was, I won't say typical of dads in that time period, but I'm hoping dads are a little kinder maybe to their children now. What were your parents like?
Well, my parents married very young. I think my mom was about 18 and a half when she married. My father was 19 and a half. And my mom had me when she was 19 and a half. So, you know, they were babies and she had five kids. By the time my mom was 26 and a half or 27, she had five kids. We were very, very poor. We grew up along the oil refineries, near the oil refineries along the Delaware River, south of Philadelphia, between Philadelphia and Wilmington. My mom just was a housekeeper trying to maintain things and keep the house going with five of us. My father worked three jobs. He sold real estate. He was an investment insurance salesman, and he also taught social dance in the evenings. They had a tumultuous relationship. It was very, very difficult. My father was an alcoholic, and the house was very violent. It was not the best environment to grow up in. But, you know, interestingly enough, things always seem to happen for a reason. And I think that because of the difficulty in my household, it forced me to want to stay out as away from the house as much as I possibly could. So that led me to a lot of extracurricular activities at school, starting in junior high school. And I went into the theater, and just being in the theater gave me the opportunity to create these characters that were, you know, someone far from my own life and live in a world of imagination and fantasy. And it really gave me a respite from, I hate to say, the horror that was going on at the house, but I have to admit that's what it was. So, you know, things happen for a reason. And in a way, I don't know if I would have gone down that path if my home life had not been that extreme.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that did occur to me that often people become achievers because of the situation you were just describing. It seems to happen. Well, while you were still there in Pennsylvania, you decided to go to this liberal arts college, and you thought you would become a trial lawyer. Vincent. But what changed your mind?
Well, I wanted to be, you know, having been so poor, I got into Dickinson College on all scholarships and financial aid. And I thought my first fantasy was maybe I should become a trial lawyer because, you know, I love acting and I could make a lot of money and I'm pretty intelligent. And so that was my kind of goal. Dickinson was attached to a law college, and I thought this is the perfect path for me to take. Well, that was a great idea until I stepped foot in the theater, the Mathers Theater at Dickinson College. And just walking through the door there, I just knew that I didn't think I could be a lawyer. I think I had to be somehow involved in the theater. And I auditioned for plays that freshmen were not supposed to participate in. And I was pretty good and I got a nice role. And I just started living in the theater and I absolutely became obsessed. And I knew that this was the path I was going to take.
Well, I thought you were going to mention somebody famous that you met and you struck up a friendship with Marcel Marceau.
I did with Mr. Marceau. It was fantastic. He had come to visit our school, and I had been encouraged by the man who led the theater there, David Brubaker, to start my own theater company because I was interested in the sort of plays that were not necessarily being put on at Dickinson. I was interested in alternative theater. I was very inspired by like the Living Theater and the Open Theater with Joseph Chaykin and the work that Peter Brook was doing. All of this inventive, new, creative work, it just inspired me. Well, one thing that happened was Marcel Marceau showed up and gave an incredible mime class. So I asked if I could meet him, and I did, and we talked and talked and talked, and I began a mime company that was kind of much bigger than mime. We took mime and sort of made it much more story-oriented with a group of 12 people. But Marcel was so kind to me and invited me to come out to Ohio after his time at Dickinson, and I went there, and I spent several days watching him perform, talking to him after, asking him so many questions just about the art form and just performing in general. He was so supportive. I still have a couple beautiful letters, like 10 pages long, where he scribbled all of these beautiful doodles in the corner. His character was named Bip, B-I-P, and he has all these little drawings of Bip all down along the side and flowers and hearts. And oh, I just cherish these letters from Mr. Marceau. Absolutely.
My guest is a choreographer and dancer. Vincent Patterson has written a behind-the-scenes story of working with some of the world's greatest stars. The title of his book is Icons and Instincts, Choreographing and Directing Entertainment's Biggest Stars. And you had a Liza Minnelli wig. And how did that come in handy?
Well, what happened? I was a hippie during my college days. You know, it was a very exciting time and a great time to be a hippie, actually, because so many things were changing, you know, women's rights, gay rights, black rights. So many things were just on the cusp of being of a revolution. And being a hippie at that time was a fantastic experience for me. It also was the time of Vietnam and participating in anti-Vietnam marches from New York and Washington, D.C., as well as in the small town where I lived with Dickinson, because it had an Army War College there. And I once had a photo that kind of became famous of me putting a flower inside the rifle of one of the men the soldiers standing in front of the war college when we were protesting. But that was exciting. So because I had this long hair down to my waist, I needed to work still. And during the summer, I got a job at the local restaurant, but they said, you've got to cut your hair. So I bought this little black wig that when I put it on actually looked like Liza Minnelli, but it worked. Except the funny thing was when I first went to work, all the people were treating me so kindly. And I thought, what's going on? Well, I found out that they thought that I had had some kind of major head or brain surgery, and I was covering it up with this little wig. But one day a lady came to knock on my door, one of the waitresses at work there, to tell me that the shift had changed and they couldn't reach me on the phone. I opened the door and there I was with my long hair, and she just gasped. She didn't know who she was talking to. She recognized the face, but not the hair. So, but the fun thing about that was when I graduated from college, I got a role playing Saeed in a play by Jean Genet at Society Hill Playhouse. And he's a Middle Eastern character. Well, I'm blonde and blue-eyed, basically, and I had this little Liza Minnelli wig, and it pulled me through the show. So that little wig had many, many reincarnations, and they all did well by me.
So you finish college, and you reach a point where you say, you know, I think I want to get out of Pennsylvania. And what provoked you to move, Vincent?
Well, two things, Nance. First, I hated the cold. I just detested the cold. And in those days, the area around Philadelphia was really drastic. I mean, we would have school closure days because the snow was blocking the doors. You couldn't get out the front door for a few days. So I detested the cold. I really did. And I told everybody when I was a little kid and growing up, young teen, you know, when I get out of school or college or whatever I'm fortunate enough to do, I'm moving to California. Well, everyone laughed at me. Nobody in my entire family or anybody I knew had ever left the area where we lived. Everybody in my family was within a 20-minute car ride. Nobody moved away. But after I finished my stint at Society Hill Playhouse, I had a friend, and she was very interested in moving and had a car. And we traveled around the South. We didn't know where we were going to go. We kept on heading further west, stopped in Tucson, Arizona to visit a college professor of mine. It was January and it was around 80 degrees. And I said to my friend, Karen, you know, Karen, I'm going to get off here. I'm going to stay here for a while. She moved on eventually to Denver, Colorado, but Tucson was the place for me. And I stayed there for about 5 years and actually began my dance career there. I had not danced prior to that.
Well, you know, I started dance when I was 7 years old, and you were 23 when you went to your first ballet class, weren't you?
I was almost 24, actually. I had been a theater mole. And when I was in high school, my freshman and sophomore year, I ran cross country and I did very well, but I was in a really bad car accident coming into my junior year and broke my foot in five places. So that kind of stopped my running career and stopped me from playing sports a lot, but I could still be in the theater. Well, years later, you know, I was 23, 24, and I was walking down the street towards my work every day, and I would pass this little dance studio, and I opened a door one day, and I looked in, and the woman who ran it, a woman named Stephanie Steiger, said, "Can I help you?" And I said, "Well, you know, I'm thinking about taking a dance class." And she said, "Well, we don't really have adult dance classes right now, but if you're really sincere, you could take classes with these girls. They're anywhere from 11 to 15. And I said, "Why not?" So I started taking ballet class. And the fun part for me was I was already an actor, so I knew how to approach a role. So that's what I did. I went to the library. I got out books on Nureyev, and looked at him in different ballet roles. And I would go into class and I would say, "Okay, today I'm Prince Charming." And I would approach my work, my bar, my ballet bar, as if I was Rudolf Nureyev playing Prince Charming. And it seemed to work, you know. It was like putting on a costume, yet my inside started to react to it. And the experience that I had not had before of endorphins just running through your system was such an incredible high to me that I couldn't get enough. I started walking around Tucson like a crazy person with a broomstick under my arms behind my back over the broomstick so that I would lift my chest up high. I carried around a backpack. And in it, I had a big Coke bottle that was filled with sand, which whenever I could, I would pull it out, take off my shoes and roll my feet over this Coke bottle to kind of get some dexterity in my feet. And also I would have a big, thick telephone book. So when I could, I would sit down on the edge of the telephone book and slowly, slowly try to get my legs into second position. Because when I began, I looked a little bit like the Hunchback of Notre Dame. I couldn't reach my knees when I bent over, let alone my toes. But, you know, I knew that if I had to do this, I had to break my body apart and build it back up again. And I was determined to do it. And I did it. I did it.
My guest is dancer and choreographer Vincent Patterson, whose book is Icons and Instincts, Choreographing and Directing Entertainment's Biggest Stars. We'll be back to continue our conversation after a short break. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my guest, dancer and choreographer, Vincent Patterson. I was in graduate school before I took modern dance, and I remember the best dancers, the ones that I really liked to watch, were theater majors.
And so
when I read that in your book, I said, yeah, theater majors, people who have acting background, really come across as dancers you want to watch.
Absolutely. One of my joys in being a choreographer has been taking dancers and teaching them about acting. So that because I'm a narrative choreographer, I like to tell stories with my movement, whether it's a music video, even a commercial or concert dance. I just like narration. I like storytelling. It's who I am. And so in order for me to tell stories and get that across, I need to create characters. So 9 times out of 10, when I'm working on a dance piece, whether it's an abstract piece or something that's very concrete, I'll spend time with the dancers. I'll have them create an autobiography or a biography about themselves and the characters they play and how they interact with the other dancers in the piece. And it infuses this incredible sensitivity. And on camera, what I love is that when the camera catches any dancer, they can go in for a close-up that can be as powerful as a close-up on Glenn Close, because something is going on in their minds. They're not just bodies moving through space. They are people who have a story to tell. I'm most proud of the short film I did with Michael Jackson of Smooth Criminal, because I spent a lot of time with this. I asked the dancers to come up with their own names. When we were on the set, there was a door that led in from the stage left side. And in order for the dancers to, even for rehearsal, I made them go through that door to get onto the stage and into the set. And when they did, they had to call each other by their character names all through the rehearsal period. Once they walked out that door, they could be the dancer that they were. But this was a revelation for so many dancers and also an utter joy for me.
Now, I want to go back to you're 24 years old and you go to this adult ballet class. Mm-hmm. And what the instructor told you brought to mind what some a talent scout wrote about Fred Astaire. And this talent scout wrote about Fred Astaire. Can't act, can't sing, can dance a little. And your instructor told you, don't come back to my class.
Well, not my first instructor, not Stephanie Steigers. It was another instructor who had a ballet company. And I thought, well, let me venture out away from Stephanie and see what else is going on in Tucson. There were a lot of modern companies. I started taking from them, but I thought I want to take another ballet class and see what it's like. So I went into this gentleman's class, Mr. Franz, and he came up to me halfway through the bar, maybe not even halfway through the ballet bar, maybe a third of the way through the ballet bar, and said, excuse me, how old are you? And I was 24 at that time. I said, 24. And he said, how long have you been dancing? And I said, just a couple months. And he said, you know, please get out of my class. You're terrible. You can't dance. You'll never make it. And you're just a waste of wasting my time. So thank you very much. But I'd like you to leave. So, you know, I was so embarrassed, but I walked out with my head down and I went back to Stephanie and it only went up from there, Nancy. It only went up from there.
Well, I just, in my imagination, I see you've been thumbing your nose at this mistaken instructor.
Internally, yes. Certainly.
Yes, exactly. And you would do something that I found very interesting. You would kind of program what you wanted in your life, like on your refrigerator, you would put photographs. But now there's one point where you did something that people, I think, would find really hard to believe, Vincent. And that is you regrew a finger. How did you do that?
Oh, okay. How did I do that? All right. I have to take you back a little bit. I don't talk about this much in the book, but I went to the American Dance Festival in Connecticut. And when I was still living in Tucson, and a woman named Anna Halpern was teaching one of the classes, and she was a very spiritual, philosophical, metaphysical teacher. Her choreography had a lot to do with with healing and your internal emotions, more than dance steps. It was a lot of improvisation, organic improvisations. Well, I was to perform one evening toward the end of the festival. I had a great solo and I was to perform. Unfortunately, strep throat was going like ravaging the dancers. I woke up one morning, the morning of the performance, and I had strep throat. Seriously, I went to the infirmary and just to be sure, and they said, you go back to the room. It's contagious. Get back there and you can't go on tonight. On my way back, I stopped by Anna Halpern's office and I told her my plight and I said, do you have any suggestions? Anything I could do? I'm totally open to anything you might suggest. Well, she gave me a visualization. She said, okay, Vincent, lie down in your room, find a place where the sun is can beam in on your neck. What I want you to do is close your eyes and I want you to imagine, try to find the most intense point of the pain that you feel in your throat right now. When you find that, I want you to visualize that area as an ice cube, one big ice cube in your throat. And then feel that sun on your throat and imagine just a visualization of it, that sun is melting the ice cube. Nancy, I did it. I did it three times within 2 hours. And it was about 3:30 in the afternoon by that point. I got up from the floor and I had no more pain in my throat. I went running to the infirmary and I said, okay, guys, something crazy is going on here. Can you tell me if I still have strep throat? And they said, well, of course you have, before they examined me. I said, please take a look. They took a look and they said, what happened to you? Did you get medication? Or I said, no, I just did this visualization thing. And anyway, it kind of freaked them out. But I was able to go on that night and do my performance and everything went fantastically well. So that was the first time I had dabbled in anything like self-healing. When I came to LA, I was, of course, a dancer. Besides taking every dance class I could, I was constantly at the gym to keep myself in strength and physical strength and good shape that way. And one day I went into the gym and I had, it was on the machines were called Nautilus machines. On the side of the machines was a big Nautilus chain that went down around to the floor and back up to the side of the machine. Well, this gentleman was on the tricep machine, and he sat in the machine, and you press your forearms down and it works your triceps. In order to be the next in line, you had to hang up a card on a little metal attachment there. And I went to put my card there. My finger was caught in the chain. I was dragged to the floor. I screamed, of course, and he let go, and the blood was splurting, and they rushed me to the hospital. And the first thing that this doctor wanted to do at Cedars-Sinai was to cut off my finger at the middle knuckle. I said, no, you can't do it. And he said, I've got to do it. You don't have anything. You don't have a top knuckle. You don't have a nail. All that's gone. It's just the middle of your finger. And it's just a little stub there. You got to cut it off. And I said, I'm not cutting it off. I said, just put stitches on it and let me deal with that first. So he put all these stitches on the top of it, closing it all up. When I went home, I researched healers. And I visited, I can't remember, 3 to 4 to 5 healers, all who did a different kind of technique. Some did color techniques, some did visualization, some did numbers, many different things. So I just started meditating daily and visualizing that my finger was in perfect condition. Now, I did 2 things. I contacted every friend I had in the world, every family member, and I asked them all, I said, if you will look at your left ring finger every day at noon, wherever you are, and just say out loud, just once, Vincent's ring finger is as perfect as my ring finger. That was part of it. The other part was me believing. And what I thought, the way I convinced myself that I could do this was I said, I did this once in my mother's womb. I grew fingers once. My body knows how to do this. Why can't I do it again? Well, I started to meditate. It started to happen. I would go back to the doctor, who was a firm non-believer. He would say, this doesn't make any sense. Your bone is growing. I started to tell him at first what I was doing, and different friends who would take me to the doctor said, don't tell the guy. He doesn't understand. He doesn't appreciate it. Just do your work. So I would go back a couple of weeks later, and he would say, this doesn't make any sense. Your finger's almost where a knuckle would be, but you'll never get a knuckle. Well, I came back a couple of weeks later, and he said, this doesn't make any sense. You're starting to get a knuckle. I came back another time. The last time I came back, he said to me, well, you've got a knuckle, but you'll never have a nail bed. Well, you'll never have a nail because you have no nail bed. My nail bed somehow appeared, and a nail started to grow. I stopped going back to that doctor, and I just continued. If you saw my finger, it's maybe a quarter of an inch shorter than the other one, but the difference would have been having that finger cut off at the knuckle in the middle. And as a dancer, as a performer who was just beginning his journey in Hollywood, I didn't want to be that guy who may have been handicapped because of my hand. And that's what happened. I was blessed, but I believed it with every ounce of my body. I believed I could do it. Could I do it again, Nancy? I don't know, but I did it then. I did it then, and I have pictures to prove it. So, yeah.
My guest is dancer, choreographer, and now author, Vincent Patterson. His book is Icons and Instincts, Choreographing and Directing Entertainment's Biggest Stars. And I can just imagine when people hear this story you just recounted about regrowing a finger, that people shake their heads and, oh, poor Vincent, he's just delusional. But it's hard to argue. If people saw your finger before,
oh yeah,
and then saw it after, do people say, gosh, there must be something to this?
Well, you know, I have a lot of people who ask me about visualization now. And I'll tell you another story about my dad that's not in the book, but my father called me up once and he was crying and he said, they just found cancer all up and down my spine and they've given me 6 months to live. Well, my father was a hard-headed man and I didn't think he would be receptive to this. But you know, when somebody's in a desperate state, you never know what choices they'll make. So I told him about this process. And I said, Dad, you're a smart man. I said, why don't you ask them, where are these cancer nodules on your spine? When you are taking chemotherapy, what I'm asking you to do is imagine, as Anna Halperin had said to me, imagine that these cancer nodes are ice cubes. And when the chemotherapy is going into your body, imagine it's a hot liquid that's going in there and melting the ice cubes. Now, Nancy, he said he did it. He also did chemotherapy and radiation. He wound up having no cancer in his body. Now, he never admitted that he believed that it was because of the visualizations, even though he did admit that he did them. In my heart and my soul, I know that's what healed him. But so people who know these stories, friends of mine, I mean, I am not a healer, but I like to at least give people information about visualization and how it can possibly work if you believe it and if you really put your heart and soul into it. So it's something that, again, as I said, I don't know if I could ever do it again. But I imagine if I'm in an extreme situation, I'll certainly go there as my first recourse.
Well, this seems hard to believe. And I also, that brings to mind a situation where you were contacted by somebody and a friend commented, you know, Vincent, you've got photographs of these two people on your refrigerator. And these two people are so unlikely. It's not like somebody who's either of these people are commonly known in the United States. And you know, of course, who I'm referring to.
I do. Lars von Trier and Björk. You know, you mentioned the refrigerator and, you know, and again, this goes to my visualizations. I mean, I'm not a religious person, but I'm a spiritual person. I believe in these things. And I, throughout my career, when I wanted to work with somebody or I was impressed with an artist who inspired me, I will put their photo on my refrigerator, whether it's Glenn Close or Elvis Presley or Lady Gaga. Lady Gaga has not come true yet, but the others have. But I had seen Breaking the Waves, a film that Lars von Trier had created, and I thought it was so innovative and fresh and new. I went to see it two nights in a row. And I put his picture on my refrigerator in the hopes that I would somehow get to work with him. At the same time, I really was very fond and a big fan of Björk. I thought she was an amazing musician, and I had her picture up there. The reason I put them on the refrigerator was not just for fun, but I felt that if I passed my refrigerator as many times during the day as we do, and I would just glance at these images, that somehow by doing that, I'm connecting on some bizarre ether wave with these people. And maybe my thought process will land inside of their thought process and we will have the opportunity to work together. Well, I'm telling you, Nancy, it works. It really works. My agent called me about this specific situation that you mentioned. Lars von Trier was doing a movie and originally called Taps, eventually called Dancer in the Dark. And he was looking for three different choreographers. They all turned out to be me. He was looking for someone who had done Madonna's tour. He was looking for someone who had done Smooth Criminal. And I can't remember what the third one was, but they all turned out to be me. My agent called and said, Vincent, it was at the stage where I was saying, I don't want to choreograph anymore, Julie. I just want to direct now. But she called and said, I have a choreography gig for you, and I don't think you're going to want to turn it down because I've seen these two people's pictures on your refrigerator. It was Lars and Björk. And that became one of the most exciting film cinematic experiences that I have ever had. It was an absolutely brilliant, brilliant time for me.
Because, oh, because her name is unusual and she doesn't even bother using her last name because it's a mouthful. But Björk she's Icelandic. She's a singer, songwriter, composer, record producer, and actress. And she wrote the music for this, for Dancer in the Dark.
Yes.
Now, I want to bring up something that you may not want to talk about. And that is these two people got along for the most part, but there was a time when she was acting so strange in your book. You know, what's the matter with her? She would quit and walk off. And then I understand, not from your book, that she had some allegations against Lars von Trier. And I don't know if you want to mention that or talk about it.
Yeah, you know, it was a very passionate set. And the beautiful thing about it is we were all sort of at the same level. That's the way they worked. It was, I don't want to say socialist, but it was that way. There was no real hierarchy. I mean, yes, Lars directed and Catherine Deneuve and Björk were the leads. But everybody, you know, we would rehearse, we would sit out on the lawn and have a schnapps together. I mean, it was one big happy family. What happened, the problem began to happen for two reasons. First of all, Björk was overworked. She was seriously overworked. They kept promising her a day off here, a day off there, and she never got them. Well, Björk is not an actress, although she did a phenomenal job in that role, but she had not been an actress before. So to step into a role that was as harrowing as being a young single mom who was slowly going blind and not knowing what to do with her child, I mean, it was a very, very difficult role for her to take on. And she took it on full-heartedly, with a passion I've rarely seen outside of an expert actress like a Glenn Close or a Meryl Streep. Just put her whole heart and soul into it. So that much energy was exhausting for her. And it was very difficult when she didn't have a day off. And so, yeah, every once in a while she would say, okay, you don't give me a day off, I'm not coming to work tomorrow. I need a break. And for me, I totally understood it. That was one problem. The second one was that Björk was really naive about how music plays in a film. From the time she was a young kid, actually, in her first band, the Sugar Cubes, she ran everything herself. She wrote it, she produced the music, she did all of that. So she had never had anybody tell her, no, you can't do this, or yes, you must do this. Well, when it came time to shoot the pieces, the dance pieces, Lars had an idea, Lars and I together, that the way she would get into these fantasies is by hearing some kind of sound, whether it be the sound of the clack of the train wheels moving, that would take her out of her difficult life and put her into a fantasy of being a star in a musical, a movie musical. Well, and the way she would come out of them was very abrupt. Something would happen, the sound would go off, and boom, she was back in the real world again. Well, when she realized that Lars's intention was to chop off the end of her songs, she went ballistic. She had no idea that's what would happen to her work. And she regarded every piece that she created like one of her babies. So it was very, very tense about the music. And they had to get Björk's people in there and Lars' people in there so that everything could be explained and it could be understood. But eventually, everything worked out. Thank God. I was so fortunate on that project. I came in as the choreographer. One day I was working with Lars and I said, Lars, you know, we're missing this actor. He was supposed to be an elderly gentleman in his late 70s and Jewish, and he ran the little theater. We didn't have him and we were going to shoot this in 2 days. Well, Lars came in the morning and I said, what are we going to do, Lars? We need this man. We need this man. Well, he put his arm around me and he took me over to the mirror and he said, Vincent, I found him. And I said, no, Lars, no, no, I don't act anymore. No. And he goes, listen, I said, plus it's supposed to be an old man. And he said, Vincent, since I've been watching you, you're the perfect. You're perfect for me. This is exactly what I want. So I wound up doing that. And then, so I was choreographing and acting, And then Lars had this crazy idea that he would shoot the principal photography with a handheld camera all by himself, but he wanted the dance sequences shot with 100 mini DV cameras. The concept being, I would create the pieces, he and I would talk, we would place 100 cameras all over the set, whatever that set might be, whether it was out in the mountains or whether it was in a factory. And we would put them in every possible position so that we could basically press record. The dance could be done from the beginning to the end. It would be captured by every single camera. And then we would hand all of this footage, sometimes two takes, but sometimes seven takes, to the poor editors who had to look at 100 cameras times seven takes to edit the dance piece down. So he said, Vince, I can't do this. This is too much for me. I'm doing the principal camera. You're a director. Can you take over the 100 cameras? So I got to direct the 100 cameras. I got to act in this movie and I got to be the choreographer. It was such a fulfilling project, Nancy.
After a break, I'll be back with my guest, Vincent Patterson, whose book is Icons and Instincts, Choreographing and Directing Entertainment's Biggest Stars. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wiegman. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wiegman. My guest is Vincent Patterson. He's author of Icons and Instincts, Choreographing and Directing Entertainment's Biggest Stars. Now, there's a choreography that I've heard of, and he is quite famous, and you replaced Tommy Tune when they were going to film, Mike Nichols was going to film Birdcage. And how did you get that gig?
Well, this is the instinct part of the title. You know, I believe that we all have this little voice inside that if we pay attention to it, it will really guide us and kind of let us know if we're on the right path or not. Well, I'll tell you what I mean by that little voice. Some people go, I don't know what you're talking about. And I give them this example. You have a glass of water. You sit it down on the edge of the table and this little voice says to you, don't leave that glass there. You're going to knock it over. And you just ignore it. And you turn around and you knock it over and it goes all over the floor. I mean, we've all had that experience happen. That's what I call that little voice of instinct. I always pay attention to that little voice. I had seen in the paper that Mike Nichols was going to direct The Birdcage. And I just knew that I was the one to choreograph this show. My instinct, my guts, my everything was just saying, Vincent, this is your project. You have got to find a way to get to Mike Nichols. So I called my agent, Julie McDonald, and I said, Julie, can you help me get to Mike? And she said, well, I don't know him, but let me see what I can do. Before I knew it, I was sitting with Mike Nichols at a little restaurant near Central Park in New York. And he was so kind to me. He said, well, tell me why you think you should do this project. He said, you know, I've already asked Tommy Tune to choreograph this, and Tommy Tune is a good friend of mine. I said, Mr. Nichols, he stopped me right there. He said, Mike, not Mr. Nichols, Mike. I said, okay, Mike. I believe that I am the one to do this because I have done this with so many incredible women, Diana Ross, Whitney Houston, Olivia Newton-John, I know how to make women sexy. I know how to help them become sexy. I know how to show them how to become sensual. Madonna as well. I said, this is one of my gifts. I've worked with some amazing choreographers, Michael Peters, Lester Wilson, to name two, who worked with, Lola Falana, so many stars who did Las Vegas and shows and incredible ladies. And I got a lot of training from them. And because I was assisting Michael Peters often with these ladies, or Debbie Reynolds, whomever, I had to wear high heels when I was the assistant choreographer. So I said to Mike Nichols, and I know how to dance in high heels. I'm telling you, I can make whoever we cast be the ladies that you want, be the drags that you want. And then he said to me another one, which scared me to death. He said, what do you think about Sondheim doing the music? And I said, oh, wow, Mike, I'm a huge fan of Sondheim, which I am. I said, but, you know, you're talking about a drag club in Miami. I said, you know, I don't really frequent drag clubs, but I'm pretty sure from what I know that most drags don't do Liza Minnelli these days. You know, they don't sing show tunes. They basically want to imitate Madonna or Donna Summer or someone like this. You know, I said, it's a whole fresh approach. And he said to me, do you know somebody who could do this? I said, yes, I just finished a project with someone who I think is an incredible composer and music producer. He said, all right, you got the job. That was it. I was speechless. I was, as I am at the moment, reliving it. It was here I was going to do this project with my hero. And just because I followed my instinct, just because something inside told me, Vincent, go for it. You need to go for this. And I really believe it. And, you know, I hope in my book that one of the reasons I wrote this book is to inspire other artists and young artists or people who are maybe at a point in their career where they're afraid that they're stagnant and they can't go on. I just think that if you stop and listen to yourself, if you keep your training up, if you're focused, if you don't step on other people's shoulders to get where you want to be, but you do it with a good heart and with great intentions, and you're talented, that's part of it, of course, but trusting yourself, giving yourself the break of believing in yourself, giving yourself the pat on the back and saying, you know what, why not me? Why not me? It doesn't always have to be the next guy. I'm as valid as anybody else. And I hope that the people who read this book, if they are artists or if they're stuck in any kind of situation where they're not moving forward, then maybe they'll be a little bit inspired by a guy who grew up along the Delaware River and wound up being part of some of the most incredible collaborations in the film and dance world that we've had in the last 30 years. I'm so humble and I'm so grateful. But it's about trusting your instinct and believing in yourself.
My guest is Vincent Patterson, and he has just explained why the word instincts is in the title of his book, Icons and Instincts. And the list of icons that you have worked with is just, we'd be here all day. Now, Michael Jackson is one that you worked with, and you mentioned Smooth Criminal.
Yeah.
And he has said that he's called Smooth Criminal his favorite short film.
Yes, he has. I always thought it was Thriller, and it wasn't only me that he told, which made me really feel good. I've had several people who worked on him on other projects who have come to me over the years and said, in fact, someone quite recently who just read the book and said, I never told you this, Vince, but when I worked with Michael on This Is It, I had a conversation with him and he told me that Smooth Criminal was his favorite short film. So, you know, it's verified. It's absolutely verified. I had such a great time with Michael Jackson. I worked with him for 17 years and a little bit more than that. I started as the gang leader in Beat It, went on to assist Michael Peters and be a dancing zombie. And from there went on to conceive and choreograph and create Smooth Criminal and so many other projects for him, including directing and choreographing his first solo tour, working on a lot of his short films. He never called them music videos, but The Way You Make Me Feel, Black or White, on and on and on. One of the most wonderful things that happened with Michael and I was that we changed the face of the Super Bowl. I choreographed and directed, I didn't direct the cameras for the Super Bowl, but I directed his performance for the Super Bowl. Don Mischer directed the cameras. But I wanted to do a show, as Michael did, something that he went by this mantra, Vincent, we have to create something the world has never seen before. Well, the world had never seen a halftime Super Bowl show with a performer coming out on a stage with dancers and a band, and then bringing out a huge globe and all of these kids running all over the field. And, you know, they were used to marching bands. But after that Super Bowl, that became the new Super Bowl halftime show. It was now about performers with dancers and sets and all of that. So, you know, so many wonderful adventures happened with Michael and me. And, I feel like he's kind of, as I wrote in the book, he's kind of the through line of my career. So many people have asked me to become part of a project because the work I did with Michael, or at least want to meet me because of the work I did with Michael. Still to this day, I just wound up directing a huge presentation for a new musical that hopefully will happen in the next year in Europe. And, you know, the kids that I was directing said, they all wanted to know about my work with Michael Jackson. You know, oh, tell us about what you did with Michael Jackson. And he was just a very, very special artist. He was such a kind man. He never raised his voice. He never spoke ill of anybody. I write this in the book, but it's so true. You know, if someone came to him with something that he didn't like a costume or a set or something like this, he would never pull a diva trip like so many of these people do. He would say, you know, that's a very interesting idea, but I was thinking maybe we could try something like this. Well, you know, he didn't have to be that way. He was the most well-known performer in the entire world, and he still had this humility about him.
Well, let me remind listeners the name of your book, because people probably don't recognize your name, but billions of people have seen your work, and that's because there is no Oscar for choreographers. Maybe your book will help change this, choreographers will get credit for their work. Thank you, Vincent, for joining us today.
Thank you, Nancy. Thank you very, very much.
My guest has been Vincent Patterson. He is a choreographer and director and dancer. And he, along with award-winning writer Amy Stoffe, has written Icons and Instincts, Choreographing and Directing Entertainment's Biggest Stars.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf, a production of North State Public Radio. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org.